Hey everyone, and welcome to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm Mike Rohde, your host, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook. And I am excited to welcome Ms. Sunny Brown to the show. Hey Sunny, what's going on?
Hey. How are you? We figured out our microphones.
Yeah, we're rocking and rolling. And you are the anchor batter in the Girl Power Sketchnote Army podcast season. So I've decided, and I talked with Mauro about, we feel like women are a huge part of sketchnoting in lots of different ways, and we wanted to celebrate them. And we thought a really good way to prove it is by actually dedicating a season.
By actually having women on. So
exactly. And when I look back at the seasons, we're actually pretty balanced, in fact.
I bet you are.
And I think that's one of the proudest things about the sketchnote community in general is I feel like we're pretty balanced across.
It's welcoming to all the spectrum. It's true. And I applaud you for that because, of course, there's always that element of extreme bias in, you know, audiences and stuff. Like, like I'm often the token female. They're like, oh, have a lady. And I'm like, but I'm white. So it ruined everything.
Yeah. Well, we're really happy that we're also very international. So we've got people from the UK, you know, from Asia, Italy, South America. So I think it's great that that it's open enough. And the other thing I like about the sketchnote community, in a way, it sort of flies under the radar, which I like. It doesn't make itself bigger than it is. It just is what it is. And people help each other out. And, you know, so it's all the best things about good community that you want.
I think you get a lot of credit for that, Mike. I mean, you know, you're humble and I know you wouldn't say that, but I think that community is built from leadership. And I know that, you know, your personality comes through in your community. And so that warmth and that kindness and that supportiveness is not just, it's not random. Like, I think that's a big part of you too.
Yeah, I would take maybe, you know, 1.5% or something, set the tone. And, you know, there's a lot of more people in this community than me. So I know we spread the credit. But anyway, so we are happy to start off the season three of the Sketchnote Army podcast. And we're going to be featuring all kinds of amazing women in this season in the next 7 episodes after this one. But right now, we have Sunny Brown. Lots of people know who you are, but there's probably people that maybe are new to you, don't know that you've written a book, that you've done TED Talks, you've done all kinds of stuff. We did a sketchnote visual thinking type workshop back in South by Southwest way back in the eons of time, like 2010. So we could talk a little bit about who you are. That would be great. So why don't you give us an intro, who you are and what you do, and then we'll sort of take it from there.
Okay, and I'll try to be ambiguous. It's hard to describe who I am because, you know, as you know, when you're an entrepreneur, you have many aspects and many facets of your work. And so I can do like the party line one, and then maybe we could talk about the spectrum of stuff.
I like that.
Yeah, okay, cool, because it's always like, and plus, you know, creatives are always evolving, and that's the other thing too, is we don't stay the same over time. So nobody does, but creatives in particular tend to adapt and move. So party line, I run a boutique consulting company, and we use 4 different techniques to support problem solving. And one of them is game thinking, design thinking, visual thinking. And the last one is improv, applied improv, which is so much fun. It's ridiculous. But and then, of course, I'm an author, as are you. And so I'm always interacting between these two personalities that I have and trying to balance them and, you know, whatever. So that's my spiel. And even that has changed since I first have known you. So that might be confusing for you even too.
Well, I knew about Game from Game Storming, so I know about that. That's a fantastic book. And we mentioned it in, I think, 1 or 2 other episodes. So if you're listening and you haven't gotten a copy of Game Storming, definitely do that. That's a combination of, I think it's you and Dave, and there's a third author.
James McNifo.
Yes. Yeah, so you three, it's a great book. It really will give you ideas for how to bring games into your creativity process. I also knew about visual thinking, of course, and design thinking is a natural
plug-in.
And actually, improv makes a ton of sense. And it's funny, I've been kicking around taking an improv class because we have a really good, we have an improv group here in Milwaukee called Comedy Sports, which actually offers classes in that. So
what would motivate you to do that?
Well, I'm doing a lot more speaking
for
companies and universities, and I feel like there could be an opportunity to loosen myself up even more. to where
okay,
I
Mike.
Can...
So I have a proposition then already for you, because Jesse and I, one of my best lead facilitators and friends is named Jesse Sternschuss, and you actually should have her on the show.
Okay.
Because she's an applied improv expert and she's phenomenal, and she does a lot of visual thinking techniques with me in group settings, and she and I are about to start coaching people on presentations and presentation skills. So you could be our first client.
Wow. Well, that would be cool, because I have a feeling that so when people get into SketchNote and they start seeing it like take over little bits and pieces of their lives, and then
yes.
And, you know, I can imagine there's lots of people here that want to use it at work, and like, how do I use it at work? And if you have sort of an improv in these other aspects, you can start doing it on whiteboards and doing there's lots of people that do it. So maybe there's some ideas that we can share with the community that way. So I love that idea.
Yeah, I think, and I love that you notice that it does integrate so easily and beautifully, not necessarily easily, but so effectively into your life that you necessarily find yourself using it for other things, which then require other skill building and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's like this beautiful language that comes into your universe, and then your universe is never the same, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. Well, so that's the party line. So let's talk a little bit more in depth, or maybe what are the changes that are going on with you
that
modify that, and maybe talk about your growth.
Okay, if you don't mind, because I might go off the reservation a little bit, because to your point earlier, when you learn visual thinking and you take it in, it does have transformative effects on your world. And so that's what happened to me over time, was that I was really gung-ho and fired up about visual literacy, and I still am. As I rode that sort of bolt of lightning, I started exploring a lot of other areas that are all in the soup. And so that's why I'm glad you asked, because I'm actually, a lot of times when I externalize things, then they become clear to me. So probably in explaining to you, I'll be like, oh, that's what I'm doing. you know, because as you know, I just moved to Colorado, and I lived in Austin for 20 years, on and off for 20 years, outside of a short stint in San Francisco for about 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And so Austin's my home, and I just moved everything, my office and my creative life and my home life, to Denver. And then, like, we've only been here a week, and I'm like, what am I doing here? Like, what was the impetus? But it was natural, and it was wonderful. There is a culture and a community and a style here that I'm drawn to, that is, because, like, you and I have been immersed in the tech space. Because, you know, you apply this work in a lot of different user experience environments and interaction design and agile and... I don't know. And I was at Southwest for like 8 years doing panels and keynotes and graphic recording, all that stuff. And after a certain point, I was just like, oh, I would like to see nature. I really would like to see some nature, you know? And that's part of why I moved here. But also, I am using design thinking and visual thinking for deeper problem solving. Mm-hmm. If that can be like a teaser for the con. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Is that too mysterious?
No, that's great. And so what's interesting is season 2 was kicked off by none other than Dave Gray, who we talked a little bit about design thinking and sort of his take on, like, he likes it. I think I know that he's had a story where he talked about he was at a meeting or something presenting, and he was talking about design thinking, and I think the leader stood up. No, design thinking is only taught in Stanford by these 5 people, or like, you know, it was
only at the D school,
right? So, and you know, I think his book, which he talked about in that podcast, and I'll hook that up in the show notes. Liminal thinking, which is along the same direction but maybe a little bit broader, sort of takes that concept and spreads it out a little bit. So I think this is the perfect audience to be talking about design thinking and how it applies. It's really more of a process in the way you think about problems than it is about some, you know, class that you go to, right? I think that's the way I look at it anyway.
Yeah, and that's really what's so robust and magical about it, is that it's like a, and I often refer to it as a portal or a doorway, because it's like you go into Narnia. You know, like, and I think anyone who, and I still really have this deep admiration for people who are incredible artists, who can render lifelike illustrations of something, because to me, they're indicating that they can see the world with nuance and a lot of calibration and a lot of sensitivity. And I think that's part of the beauty of what can seem to be superficial. is right. that you actually, it actually introduces you to paying really deep attention.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit how these four areas that you've mentioned apply? Like, so let's say you have a client, a theoretical client. How would you take those four and how would they apply in an engagement with a client?
So fun. That's what's cool about this work is that it's hard, but it's pleasurable. So I'll give you an example. So right now we're designing an annual summit for GE, and we did it last year, and it was a smash, which we were like, well, duh, because it's like the techniques like do it for you, you know? and so we're doing it again this year, but with totally different goals. And so, for example, this year the intention is to understand sort of empathic human-centered design so that GE can transform some of their products based on an awareness of the actual humans that are using their products, right? And so the challenge is, how do you get designers to be empathic? I mean, that's not an easy thing to do, right? Because people like it. People like to be empathic, and they like to sort of pay lip service to it. But how do you actually create an experiential process that gives people at least an insight into what it feels to occupy someone else's life, someone else's shoes? And so we're going to use all of those techniques, like some game facilitation, some design thinking, large scale visual thinking, because as you know, that was my original field, was mm-hmm. like large scale stuff. Mm-hmm. And then of course improv to sort of warm it up and keep it unintimidating, although improv can be intimidating, but it's also like it dissolves boundaries between people. So we'll basically use those techniques to create a sequence of experiences that would, optimally lead to some insight around empathic design that they didn't have before, you know? I was just talking to them this morning about, like, I mean, because that's conceptual. So I'm trying to think of a hands-on experience. Oh, so like at dinner, you know, that they have dinners the night before, they fly in all the designers, mm-hmm. and we were going to have them play a game called Things Uncommon. So they can draw something about themselves that people don't know, or they don't think people know about them. And then you try to pass those cards around to see if there's anyone who's like you at the table or anyone who's not like you. And so that's just like a small example of how you can integrate interactivity with visualization with improv and then create a really cool experience.
Interesting. It makes a lot of sense to integrate those things and to do it, especially in an experience like this. Uh-huh. And, I'm a big believer in empathy, being a user-centered design guy and
I bet you have a lot of experience with that.
So I think understanding what people really go through, so having done lots of usability testing and observing uh-huh. users using tools that are frustrating to them, and then being able to take that, I mean, that's the best feeling ever, is when you build something and you do your best shot at it, mm-hmm. and then you watch people use it and you find out that, you know, you didn't quite get it right.
Yeah, but it's hard. It's not easy to get it right.
But I think the joy is in that, knowing that by getting that feedback, now you can make it better. Like it actually is the answer to the question. Like if you just pushed it out into the world and said, that's good enough, which lots of software is like that, right? They don't necessarily want to hear what the users think, because it's not cool, right? But if you actually, it may actually end up being more boring than what you initially thought, but it actually is more usable. So I think building empathy in this GE design community sounds really great. And I think there's opportunities for us as visually minded people to start thinking mm-hmm. of things that way. Like, how do we put ourselves in the other's shoes so we can, adapt and understand where they're coming from and actually deliver something that's more aligned to what they need. So that's exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting. And I think that's one of the reasons why the visualization piece is so powerful, because it's like, it's harder to contest the reality when everyone's looking at it. You know, like when you're just speaking and you're just sort of asking questions or interviewing and you're using a linguistic modality, then there's just like, if you talk to a lawyer, you know, they have, they use language deliberately to convolute mm-hmm. things and mm-hmm. to tell stories. And there's something true about visualization work that at least it can be co-created and modified and shared by other people's lenses in a way that is just sort of unique to it, and in a certain capacity. And the empathy piece is also really big for me. And I'm interested in how you got interested in that, because I always wonder how people arrive at that understanding of how important it is, you know. And we can talk about that later if you don't, you know, want to tell that story.
Well, I mean, in the short note, I was probably more attracted to the user interface perspective, because I'd always been fascinated by these devices and technology and things, small objects, and how they, as a Palm Pilot guy, and you know, I had Macs really early, and so I was always interested in, like, how does this all fit together? And so I was initially drawn by that, and then when the opportunity came to join Gamal Research and Design, where I work, they presented it as, like, you know, this is how we've found the best way to do it is by, you know, we observe how people actually, you know, use the things, or if we give them like a mock-up or something. And we never listen to what, I mean, they don't never, but we listen to what people say, but we don't believe what they say, because it's not because we don't want to believe them. It's because they don't really know what they're saying. They're actually telling you what they think you want to hear a lot of times.
And, or they're telling you what they think they would need, but they haven't actually turned toward an investigation of what they need.
Right.
It's so interesting.
So you have to observe, like, the best way to do it is to observe someone actually doing something, because then you get the real unfiltered, because they forget, because in our minds, we sort of gloss over the little five little steps that we do to get to this step two, right? You think step one, step two. Well, actually, there were five things you did in between step one and step two, but you just forgot.
You're totally oblivious to them. And, you know, because because your mind needs to go on autopilot, you know, like it doesn't want to fracture everything that you do into pieces. But when you start to look at it, you're like, oh, wow, there's a whole lot going on there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I sort of came into it from wanting to be better at, I felt like I realized I was really interested in user interface. And then once I got into the company and had opportunities to sit in, like, on my very first usability test, I was like, oh, this is way cooler than just interface, right? Like, I can actually watch how people are thinking and then make my stuff better. Like, that's the gold right there. So that's what hooked me.
I love it. Have you seen that video called the Backward Bike?
Yes, I have. Yeah, where they invert it.
I'm having a flash of that video because it was about how the mind has default programming, so to speak, and then to get it unlearn something, it's really challenging. Yeah. You know? So that's the other reason why part of what's been happening in my work over time has been this evolution into an exploration of the mind and how it works, and then how you can use that knowledge and enter into that knowledge using visual thinking and game thinking, because that's just where my journey has taken me. Because, you know, when you facilitate groups all the time, at the end of the day, you're looking at human behavior. And so I've been looking at human behavior for, you know, a decade, including my own. And it's also just another beautiful application of visual thinking that might surprise people. You know, I think I think people consistently underestimate what you can do with it.
Well, I think that's exciting too, because you, like me, we sort of come into this visual thinking thing through that doorway. But once you, it's I think you go back to the original thing you're talking about. Like, you come through the doorway of visual thinking, but then you realize that there's all these other doorways inside the hall, right, that you can go through and see, like, they're all related.
So beautiful.
And hopefully, you know,
I know,
those that are listening here will also be intrigued by these areas and sort of explore it, because I think there's definitely connections. It's an integrated way of thinking about creativity that's not just limited to sketchnoting or design thinking, or, you know, these all integrate, and there's opportunities based on your perspective and what's interesting to you to overlap these things and see how you can bring a unique perspective to them, right?
Exactly. And I'm so interested in all because you've been such a good community engagement person. I'm terrible at consistent, you know, touch points with my people. I'm just terrible at it for 100 reasons, but I've always noticed that you stay connected. So I bet you have a lot of really interesting insights about how people are applying it that I would be surprised by.
Well, and I think it's helpful for me. So I'm pretty busy. I've got you know, family and work and stuff, so I can't do as much as I would like to, at least in the current.
You make it look like you know what you're doing.
Yeah, I guess it's all how you look, right? But I've got lots of people in the community that really help me. You know, probably the biggest one is Mauro Ticelli, who helps. He basically runs Sketchnote Army for me and proposes great ideas and has all these crazy things that he wants to do, and I love it. So
where does he live?
He lives in Italy, so he's an Italian guy, really great guy. And but there's all kinds of other people. Many of which still need to be on the podcast. And what I sort of my approach to the whole thing has been, how can I open this thing up? Because every other approach to sketchnoting is this idea that we're going to lock it down, we're going to copyright it, we're going to chase after you with lawyers if you use our word and if you don't do it the way we want. And like, I just keep thinking, like, what if I just go the other way? I feel, if you ever watch Seinfeld, there was that episode where George Costanza decides to do everything the opposite that he normally does, and suddenly he finds a beautiful girlfriend and gets a new job, and like everything turns out great because he does like the opposite. So
that's awesome.
You know, I'm just trying to think, like, so if the so-called right way to do it is to like own the copyrights and chase after people and like, you know, and you know, whatever, like, how can we go the opposite way? And I feel like the opposite way is to let the community drive what it wants and just be on board as much as I can to help support that. Right. Like that.
Yes.
But it's challenging, and, you know, cause it's not always what I would do. But I think what I found is in the long run, what the community wants to do is always turned out better than what I would ever have thought up, you know, on my own. That, right.
Well, totally. And there's so many good historical experiments of that. So like, if you take the term mind mapping, you know, Tony Buzan copyrighted it or trademarked it, or he copyrighted it a long time ago. And, you know, there were many years when you couldn't use the term mind mapping without either crediting the Buzan company or without adding a TM or a circle C. And so, you know, I mean, it's still spread, and he got the workshops and got the book rights and had, you know, built communities, like basically the only people who could train in mind mapping really at the initial onset were the Buzan people. And then you have game storming, which was Dave's whole notion of it was to own nothing. Like, it was open source, completely open source. And, you know, so that's my experience, because I have the same pressure. People are like, you need to trademark info doodling. And I'm like, people don't really use it that much. Like, I don't really need to, but it's too many syllables. But, and also it has the word doodle, which is a wonderful, semantic conversation to have. But, but I've already had experience with game storming that was really valuable, and people are having game storming workshops all over the world and charging for them, and we don't get paid. I mean, we don't even know they're happening in a lot of times. So, you know, in a world where monetization is your priority, then yeah, that'd be heretical, but it's not, I mean, if you stop it, if you care about what you're doing, then you want it to be spread, not necessarily monetized all the time. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't capture all those buckets anyway.
No.
Like, I don't want to build a 400-person enterprise. It's just not my jam.
Yeah.
So I'm all for. So I think your instincts probably are aligned with your values. You know, is my guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think back to, I think it was 99 or 2000. Here's another book, Seth Godin's Idea Virus. I don't know if you've read that book. So his idea was actually the ideas that survive without the person having to push them. Like, if it's a good idea, it will survive on its own. And he took it farther by, I think he wrote the book and released it for free. And because he wanted it to spread, the idea to spread. I'm sure that was influential. I know Dave was really influential in the way I thought about the community and what I wanted to do. Another one, you may know this person, Jeffrey Zeldman, who sort of runs the
he's awesome. You know,
web standards. Like, his perspective on the community is another influence in my life, and how he seemed to find really great people and then turn them loose to do great things. Like, I'm sort of have all these role models that I follow. But
yeah, that's awesome.
So, but you know, this podcast is really about you, not about me. So.
Sorry. I do a lot. I end up interviewing the people that are interviewing me.
That's
because they're just as interesting, you know, if not more so. So I'm always like, well, you tell me. Sorry.
Well, it's definitely in context to what we're talking about. So I'm just being a little,
yeah.
A little silly. But people are coming to hear Sunny. They've heard enough of me. But
glad, because I feel like I've been babbling. Go ahead.
So it sounds like you're just really sort of integrating these four main areas, and I'm sure there's probably other ones that you maybe don't, you know, experience. So experience design could be part of that, customer experience and user experience. And
well, and actually the other piece that is, and I put them on my website finally, but the other piece that are, how do I describe it? It informs, they each inform each other. So I simultaneously hold these like globes. One of them is those four techniques that we've been talking about. And the other one is this sort of mindfulness, emotional intelligence, personal growth, self-awareness, like discipline. Cause that, you know, that's a huge, huge industry at this stage. I mean, there's already like, there's a conference called Wisdom 2.0 and it's been around for 3 years. And it's like, it's so weird because the Silicon Valley, you know, sort of design thinking, influence also has had a big influence. Like Google trains people in meditation, right? So it's part of their employee, you know, team performance, you know, curriculum or whatever. And so that, so, and I've been training in that stuff for a decade too, for a really long time. And so I started getting really torn about like, do I want to pursue that facet of growth of like, cause like I said, I'm a facilitator. So I'm always witnessing team dynamics that may be difficult and paying it to even managing clients, you know, it's like, what is happening in this person's world so that I can be supportive of, or at least aware of. And so I'm at this weird crossroads where I'm like, do I just keep doing the consulting and facilitation around these techniques that I love? Do I go like totally off the reservation? Cause my next book that I'm writing is not about visual thinking at all, you know? And I think it's going to confuse people. And I think it's also going to like ignite people. So whatever happens. So I struggled with that sort of like roads diverging. And then I finally was like, I'm going to integrate these two things, you know? And so now I'm designing games for mindfulness and self-awareness and personal growth. And then trying to put it in a corporate setting where it's not too freaky.
Right.
But it's still deeper than a surface exploration, you know? Well,
ultimately, you're helping human beings explore creativity and become more creative and more aware of themselves and others, really. I mean, if you boil it down.
Yeah.
How you go about it is maybe you're shifting the tools that you're using to get people to that place. And it's not like you're going to abandon visual thinking. You're just going to emphasize something else, right?
Yes, that's right. And which kind of is back to what we were talking about how it morphs. And so that's what I've been really enjoying, this collaboration with Jesse, who I, totally should have on, because we are and customers are asking for that, you know, like, I mean, we've had people call and say, you know, our onboarding process is terrible, but what they really mean is that retention is terrible. And what they mean by that is that communication is terrible. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, oh, well then how do we design an experience where people understand what is it like to communicate with someone? Not like you're a corporate, you know, monkey, but more like as a human, you know? So in a weird way, it's not been hard to sneak in some depth of practice stuff, because at the end of the day, it affects performance and it affects outcomes and it affects relationships, wherever humans are, that's what's going on.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the heart of it.
But but the next book, I'm like, I don't know what. Well, I know the table of contents. I know every chapter, but I have no idea how the response will be. Like, sorry, that is.
Are you allowed to say what it is yet, or is it still?
It's called Untangled.
Oh, okay.
It's called Untangled, and I've been researching it for a decade, and I've been earnestly capturing content around it for about four years, and then. Penguin was my last publisher, and it's like in the family of the War of Art.
Okay.
You know, and totally inspired by that. Do you know that book?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's like one of the best books ever. And it's in that family. It's very simple. It's very powerful, hypothetically. And it's kind of timeless, but it has to do with, going inside and figuring out, what your operating system is on the inside so that you can perform better on the outside, you know, but it's a divergence. Like I'm going to have illustrations in there, but I think a lot of people are going to be like, I'm sorry. So the game lady and the doodle lady just published a book about like self-awareness. They're like, what?
Well, you know, I mean, Dave Gray's got the reputation of being a visual thinking leader. But, you know, liminal thinking is much, probably not so far away from Untangled. Like he talks about how do you look at the way you think so you can reprogram what you believe so you can then change how you live, right? Ultimately.
Oh, is that what the book is? I've seen it, but I haven't read it.
I think that's, I've begun
the
reading
general
it.
Idea.
Yeah, that's sort of the general direction. And it's, methods for allowing yourself to think your way out of the way you are now by being aware of your perceptions and your biases and those kind of things, so you can then be real and then make changes.
Yeah, so that's interesting because there's an intellectual concept and then there's an emotional piece that I would be interested to see if they're both in there. Because people are not uncomfortable with the intellectual notions of things like reframing or looking at biases. People get more uncomfortable when you talk about emotional transactions and stuff like that.
And that, you know, so, Dave Gray's probably listening to this podcast banging the table, Mike, no, that's not what my book's about. No, I doubt. I think that was the gist that I got a sense from, and from the podcast I've heard him on talking about it. So
no, it makes sense. I think that's probably a good synopsis.
Yeah.
And I love the image on the cover where there's like a balloon. I think there's like a red balloon coming out. But you know, that's just a wonderful way to say it, that you have patterns and habits and they can be investigated and something new emerges. I mean, that's beautiful.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, now that it sounds like you're spreading beyond just doing the visual thing, you're not abandoning it, but you're actually just building on top of it and expanding your skills. But a lot of people that are listening are really into sketchnoting, visual thinking, using these tools. And you've been doing it for a long time like I have, and I think there's probably lots of advice that you can give us. So are there any tools that you've found over time, because you've been doing it for a long time? And I think probably we should state, too, that you know, my focus has been primarily on small scale stuff, notebooks and stuff like that, where you shine when you're at a giant board in front of you and like 20 different color markers and you're flying around. Mm-hmm. And like that's where your at least that's where your history came from, right? With the Grove. And I know your story of going to the Grove. And so why don't you tell that story, how you sort of got into visual thinking and then transition into what over the years that you've been doing visual thinking, what are the tools that you've found like have survived the test of time? Like these things I still keep using. There's no way I can not stop using these things. And I think those would be valuable for people.
Okay. That's cool. So the Grove story, I was just graduated from LBJ. So I had a master's in public policy, which turned out to be not at all related to what I'm up to. And I moved to San Francisco with just moxie and optimism and, you know, all that. And then I couldn't find a job for like, I don't know, 6 months or something. Mm. And, it was humbling to say the least. So I was like, this is in San Francisco.
And LBJ is,
cause I didn't know anybody.
Lyndon B. Johnson.
That's right. LBJ? That's in Austin.
Okay.
It's like the JFK school, but it's the LBJ school. But,
Got it.
But I was in San Francisco, which turned out to be fortuitous because that is sort of a seat of visual thinking and design thinking. But I didn't know that at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was just like doing weird things like serving muffins to people, and like passing out flyers on the street, just like whatever, like I couldn't get a job, you know? And then somebody, like a 9 degree of separation, sort of Kevin Bacon move, somebody said, well, there's a job opening at this company called The Grove. I mean, this is the kind of thing that makes you wonder if there is order in the universe, you know, because it was there was no reason I would have ended up there in any way, you know. And so I ended up being David Sibbett's assistant. And David Sibbett is like, if you're the one of the fathers, he's like the grandfather in the United States of large scale visual thinking. And so I ended up being his assistant, which is about as cool as it can get in terms of experiencing a really deep practitioner applying it in really meaningful ways. And that was just the luckiest shit that ever happened. I was like, what? I was serving muffins like a week before that, you know?
Wow.
So that was the first time. And I came having no visual literacy of any kind, very, very word focused. Cause I was schooled. So I went through all the academic stuff and, had no skillfulness in visual thinking. And then when I watched these practitioners, I started realizing like, oh, this is a language. Cause my undergraduate degrees were in journalism and linguistics. So I was very much a language lover. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So once I stopped thinking of it as an art, as I know you have emphasized too. And I started thinking of it as a language. And when I did that, that changed everything for me. Hmm. And so I worked there for 2 years, and then I moved and I learned as much as I could. And then I moved back to Austin and started a business, doing large scale graphic recording, which, is not for the faint of heart, cause it's scary, cause people and everyone's staring at you.
Well, and if that's not scary enough, then you do graphic facilitation, where not only are you doing that, but then you're managing a room of, you know, people.
Yeah.
So it's harder from there.
It's no joke. That's why over time, Mike, I started having co-facilitation, because I was like, why am I carrying this giant load by myself? I mean, it's more pleasurable to work with other facilitators anyway. So, but it took me like 7 years to figure that out. You know, I was like, I'm going to pass out from exhaustion. and then, by the way, there's other people in the world that can help.
Yeah, awesome. You can tag team. And I think that's what I think is really encouraging for maybe someone who's just started sketchnoting, maybe stumble into the podcast, or someone who feels like they're not an artist. Who, when I do teaching, I run into people like that all the time. And my goal is just to get through the hour or the 4 hours or the 8 hours of workshop to get them to the place where they feel like they can produce something, right? And I think hearing your story, having you come in with a language focus and not having any background at all, and then becoming a graphic recorder, super encouraging. Mm-hmm. Anybody really can do it, right? It's a mindset and it's a learned behavior that you can pick up. So that's super encouraging.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, no, and I hope it is encouraging. And I mean, I will, like, one caveat is that, because I've taught, you know, hundreds of people, and people do have specialties in this area. So, like, some people are really skillful at typography, and, like, that's their jam. And then they get mad at themselves if they're not really skillful at faces. And I'm like, it's not important that you kick ass at every level. It's like, let your natural skill be the one that you follow, and then see what unfolds. Because, you know, I've tried to teach listening skills, because, as you know, a huge part of sketchnoting and graphic recording is the listening piece.
Yep.
And the distillation piece. And there are people that just, that is not going to show up for them. Like, they are not auditory learners, and it's not their strength. And I'm like, that's okay. Like, I wouldn't be a graphic recorder if that wasn't my strength.
Right.
Because that's what you're basically being paid to do that. But if you, there's so many different angles that can be useful, that I just wanted to sort of clarify that it's okay if you're not good at all of it. Like, that's not the point.
You find your groove. And I would imagine someone who maybe isn't as great, like, the listening is the tough part for them. Maybe actually reflection is better. So they might listen to something and maybe take some scribbly notes and then reflect on it and then sit down and produce something based on the reflection that might be just as meaningful as someone who's capturing it in the moment. And that's the thing that I've tried to encourage in the community in general is, people want to sort of describe sketchnoting as, it's only taking notes of someone live.
Interesting. Not at all.
No, I think it's much broader. And in the second book, I did sort of try to break that down a little bit, that it can be used for, you know, idea generation. And honestly, you know, sketchnoting is more or less a proxy for learning how to think like a designer, which ultimately is design thinking. So, a way of thinking about things that doesn't rely so much on necessarily words, but, you know, it can use them.
Yeah. That's an excellent thing to reinforce, because there are a lot of people who can get distracted by auditory content. So I'm like, okay, so don't try to link it. It's not, you don't need to. Like, I know people that have taught themselves organic chemistry from taking their textbook that has all the language and then creating a visual, an info sketch or whatever you want to call it, based on what they learn. And in that way, processing the content and understanding it. So I'm like, awesome.
Yeah.
Like, there doesn't need to be a judgment about how it's used. It's more about, like, being willing to explore it and see where it takes you. So I'm glad that you have that orientation.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it's much broader, and the more I get into it, the more I'm encouraged that there's so many different ways. And I think that's, again, so we come back to community. The thing that I'm most excited about is when people take it in directions I could have never imagined. So, and I probably brung up my friend Rob DeMio, who he's a physicist and he uses sketchnoting to think through concepts that he's doing at work. So he's a director for an organization in DC called NIST, and they do this testing of materials and the results that they have. Uh-huh. If you're a member, you get it, and if you're not, then you have to pay for it. But and he has these amazing scientists coming through and giving talks all the time, right? And he felt like he was losing this opportunity to capture the knowledge and expand his own knowledge about different disciplines. And so he got into sketchnoting and decided to try it. And he found that he couldn't do the live sketchnoting. It was too difficult because the stuff was just way too technical.
Yeah.
And so his solution was, well, I know that John Smith is coming in 2 weeks. Why couldn't I like read everything that he's written and understand where he's coming from and learn, you know, the basics of what he's talking about? So by the time he gets here to give his talk in 2 weeks, I know it. And now I can act live and I can start taking and understand and putting the pieces together and linking it.
Yeah.
And then not even feeling the pressure that that sketch note that he took even has to be the final one, right? He could then continue to reflect.
Yes.
Get the exact details, talk to the person after the talk, and then with all that information now produce a sketch note that actually captures what he's thinking or she's thinking, and produce, you know, some kind of a document that now can be shared with other physicists to help them understand this discipline that's maybe
right next to it, right? Yes. I mean, of course, absolutely. I mean, I love that he found his way,
right?
That's the whole deal. And I was thinking about, so when we do a lot of facilitation and live graphic recording, totally different disciplines but related, we do a ton of preparation. I mean, my team and I mean, we do not go in cold. Like, you go in, it's like if you're in the military and you're going to, like, you know, storm a beach or something. Yeah. you know what I mean? Like, you don't just be like, oh, I don't know what the beach looks like. I have no idea where the, you know, where the hills are. I don't actually know where snipers could be located. It's like, no, because we're in high pressure situations because people are hiring, you know, paying us to to deliver.
Yep.
But yeah, it's like, you know, if the pressure is low, then I wouldn't necessarily do that. But I'm respecting and honoring the fact that he was like, oh, I'm not good at that, but here's another way to make it work.
Yeah.
Like that, like, more power to him.
And you know, I love that. And no feeling that he has to conform to some preconceived description of what it is, right? It's open enough that it's this idea that you can use visuals to think, right? I mean, it comes down to that.
Period. Like,
how can we use this in an interesting way? And then, I mean, that's sort of what I've tried to foster, at least in my little part of the community, is that, well, this is sort of the basic kernel of the idea. Where can you take it? And now I see lots of educators, teachers who love this concept because it opens up children who are very visual to making use of, like, if you didn't give them sketchnoting, they would just screw around and sketchnote or draw or doodle or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, right? So why not take this and then recapture it as something they can actually be proud of, and it would actually help them understand.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of that going on.
Oh, tons of it. And that's what I love about, if I can toot both of our horns, that I think that is one of our biggest contributions is in the education space, because I get emails. I mean, I see teachers talking about sketchnoting all the time. And I also get emails regularly from people who are like, thank you so much for this because my kid is this way, and then, or I was this way, or the whole classroom is now this. I mean, that's my favorite part. Mm-hmm. You know, like, companies are geared to problem solve, and that's they're super motivated to do that. But classrooms are always like, well, we have rules and regulations, and we can't have parents pissed off and like the whole thing. Yeah. And so it's just so heartwarming to see the change in the education space. And I'm not saying that we get all the credit for that. I'm saying, like, I'm glad that if I died tomorrow, that is one thing I'd be really proud of.
Yeah, we had a little part in that, and I think that's very encouraging. So I agree. That's super heartwarming, I think, and encouraging, you know, especially with a son who's very, you know, much like that and needs needs AI's ADHD. So he needs, you know, that opportunity to use his complete facilities. And I think that everybody can use that. So
is he a kinesthetic learner, meaning like, does he move around a lot too?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. I'd love you could do a usability, you know, testing with him, be like, watch him in a classroom just to see what he's doing to cope and sort of stay there. That'd be really interesting.
That'd be fascinating. I think that's another whole vein that we could mine. But so that's where you came from. And then of course we opened with what you're doing now and how you've taken this path from the Grove to graphic facilitation and recording into where you're heading now. So talk a little bit about what tools you've found have stood the test of time with Sunny, like, that have actually survived, right? Like, oh, this looks like a great thing. And then next week it's like, this sucks. I'm not using this ever again, right?
Right. Well, so the large scale piece for me is huge. Mostly because I think it might be because I'm mentally ill. I'm not sure. I need large space in order to understand the ecosystems that I'm playing around with. And part of that is because of the context, you know. So like working with FedEx and with their digital access team, and, you know, when I cannot go in and teach FedEx collaboration unless I understand their planet.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so for me, I need space. Like I need, like every office I've ever occupied, the first thing I look at is wall space. I'm like, what do you got here? Because if there's a bunch of windows, that's awesome, but I can't, I need to have a palette that is big, you mm-hmm. know? And I think that that always surprises people when they do it, because like you said, it can be intimidating, if you're in front of other people, for sure. And I can coach people through past that. But it's actually a different portal when you go big. Mm-hmm. And, so for me, that's not going to change. Now I work small scale all the time. Like for my 2017 New Year's, I call them aspirations. I just did, you know, like 11 by 17. Mm-hmm. Cause I didn't want to get bigger than that. Cause then I'd be like, oh, and then go on a diet and then also adopt a puppy and then like move to Africa. So I was like, I'm just going to confine myself to a certain amount of space. Yeah. So that I can't go too crazy. So for me, recognizing the white space that you're giving yourself and how that impacts your thinking process is significant, and that's never going to change, you know?
So is that feeling of expansiveness, like you probably won't run out of wall space in a day, or like, you know, you feel like you could go there even if you don't use the whole thing? Is that
It gives you possibility. Yeah.
Okay.
And then in terms of tools, I don't know if you were going to ask that one,
yeah.
but they're called Zig Riders, and they're my favorites. They're like, they have one end that's, you know, kind of round and big and another end that's thin. And I just find them to be, they give me a, control. So they're not loosey goosey. Like I can make the exact mark that I want to make with the Zig Rider, which I love. And it's archival ink, which I also love. But you know, I don't even know if you were asking that. I was just throwing that out there.
No, definitely the fans of the podcast love hearing about new tools that they especially maybe never heard of.
Have you heard of those?
I've not heard of those.
I
just got turned on to Neuland markers and bought some for the whiteboard stuff.
Yeah, those are hot.
Those are great too.
Yeah, they have a great color palette, Neulands do, and they're refillable, so you can't really argue with that.
Yeah.
And the German country makes like some of the best facilitation tools ever. Like I have static notes from Germany that are essentially, they are whiteboard sticky notes. So they're the size of sticky notes, small ones, but they're whiteboards and they stick only through static electricity. Mm. Oh, just wow. The coolest things. Yeah. Nice. Like right. Predict. Yeah. But in terms of anything that has, I guess, long story short, test of time for me is process stuff, not necessarily physical stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and it's a like space to work in and then a few tools, but it seems like, you know, if you had to, there's crappy whiteboard markers there, you'd use them. And
I'm almost tool agnostic except for Tombows and Zig Riders. Love them.
So Tombows, is there any specific,
they're like the paintbrush markers. So they also are dual tipped and they have one end that's paintbrushy and it's not watercolory, but it's got like flow.
Okay.
And then the other end is more specific and fine tipped, and they have a great color palette too. So those markers, I will probably buy them as long as they make them.
Okay. And I knew about the Tombow brand, but I don't know much about the detail. I think I've mm-hmm. played with them, but haven't really owned those. So that might be something, again, even
I
me,
might
like,
be a good present for
yeah,
you.
I'm just sitting here like writing stuff down that I got to buy. So that's how I got in the Neulands. I had someone, I'd known about them for a long time. And someone on the podcast said, Mike, you should buy some. And then I did. And now they're fantastic. So,
oh, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Guido is the owner of it. And I think he'd be delighted to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you keep your palette of tools pretty simple and then you just use space. It sounds like you tend to like to work on big sheets of paper, or are you okay with whiteboard markers?
I'm not a huge whiteboard person because it's too, I don't have the traction. It's not good. I mean, I had somebody, I was working at Disney once and I had an artist come up to me and he said, like, you have the fine motor skills of a painter. like a pointillistic painter. Mm-hmm. So I do like to have traction.
Okay.
So that's why I don't love whiteboards. And I will facilitate games on whiteboards where people are sticking things up on them. Mm-hmm. And also when other people want the ability to erase, because I don't want the ability to erase, like, okay, if I'm working live, because I'm capturing, like, I'm tracking while I'm working. So if I misspell something, I'll just scratch it out and, like, it's not a problem, you know, like, I don't care.
You're not worried about that?
No, not at all. But when, which I understand people are, and I actually address that to a certain extent in the Doodle Revolution, because I know people are terrified of that. But I do it sometimes just to model the iterative process. I'm like, it's fine. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not up here to be a perfect person. I'm up here in support of the group process. Mm-hmm. But if people are scared, then I will give them whiteboards, because then they can erase and change and all that stuff, and then they feel more comfortable.
Like training wheels or something, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah, like, and if you've ever been to one of Dan Rome's workshops, he gives people probably, I don't know, 5x6 or 8x10 whiteboards, like little lap boards. Mm-hmm. And I know people just go goo-goo over those.
Mm. Yeah, I'm friends with Gabriel, who does the beta book, which I don't know if you've heard
of. Oh, I love the beta book. Yeah, I've got 25 of them in my office right now.
So those are fantastic, too. And
I love them. Yeah, sorry. Let me clarify. I love me a beta book. I mean, I just did a workshop. I just did a workshop in Austin, and that's what we used.
Yeah.
You know, because they can pass them around. They can, mm-hmm. I mean, they have features that are fantastic. So no, that's no diss on whiteboards.
You stated that you're agnostic. So, I mean, every situation has different needs. So you go with the thing that fits.
That's right.
Are there any sources of, like, if you need big sheets of paper, you just get them at the paper store, or is there?
I still buy mine from the Grove, which is not economically feasible, really. but also Uline, they sell them in big boxes. So if you know you're gonna use a lot, or you can share with other people, and then I buy them in 25 yard rolls and 50 yard rolls. 25 yard is better because it is easy to roll, like to physically hold up and roll along a wall.
Okay.
But yeah, Uline has them, and you can buy them in bulk, and it's cheaper.
And then you just have a scissors to cut them off where you need to, or something?
No, you have a box cutter, and you always carry it in your pocket. Because if you're taping it up and then you've rolled 10 feet out and you don't have a box cutter, then you're like, damn.
You're in trouble. Yeah. Cool. Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I've never been formally trained in graphic facilitation, or recording.
Do you want to be here?
Yeah, I think I've actually often thought it'd be fun to do it and see how much of what I do naturally translates.
Oh, yeah, what I could learn from. I feel like you'd pick it up fast. I'm sure you would. In fact, you know what I think would be one of the hardest things for you is, like you said, improv. It might behoove you to take an improv class. Mm-hmm. I don't know that about you, but most people, that's not natural for most people. So that's a guess. But also, I think because your skillfulness with illustration you would have to dumb it down. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you would have to be less masterful at that, because you need to work faster. So, again, I will, like, come see me and we will just do this. We'll do presentations. Yeah.
My wife is in love with Colorado. So, like, going to Colorado is not a hard thing to do. So
no, it's beautiful. And where I live is gorgeous. And I have a huge house, and I can just, y'all can stay with us.
There we go. I think we're all set. Well, I think as sort of something I've learned having done. So what I'm doing now is with the software teams I lead, we do use whiteboards. We have a giant whiteboard wall. So that's why I got the Neuland whiteboard markers.
Oh, cool.
And I found that actually doing that with them has forced me to do the same thing. Like, really simple. Like, how do I listen to what they're saying and then produce sort of an approximation so we can talk about the same thing? So that's actually been really good training. So I think it might actually help me if I did take, you know, graphic recording training of some kind. I would probably, it would help me. But still on the list of things that'd be fun to do.
In 2017.
Yeah, to just sort of, and I think that's good, like to sort of cross train and understand where other things are at. And then, you know, I may not take everything for everyday work, but there might be some things that really apply that I could make use of. So
And normally when I have a client and I'm training them in, so they'll call and they'll be, I want to know everything about graphic recording. And I'm always like, probably you don't. So maybe you should tell me a little bit more about your job and what you're and how you actually conduct yourself. And then we can pick the skills that you actually need.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the assessment is really important.
Well, I think this is a perfect segue into, we talked a little bit about tools and stuff and skills. When we began, I sort of mentioned that what we do at the end of each podcast is to offer you the opportunity to share three things of any kind. It can be mindset things, it can be process things, it can be tool tips. We've gotten all kinds of them. So any three things that you think would help someone. So if somebody's listening to this, maybe they're somewhat new to sketchnoting or visual thinking or any of these areas we've talked about, and they just want to know, like, what will help me progress. So what are three things that you might offer to someone to help them progress along this path?
Cool. Okay, so I think I'm glad you gave me like a heads up that you would ask me that, because that's always such a hard question. Yeah. But one thing I'll say is not needing permission. I've noticed that, and it's true for me too, that we can often get daunted by innovating or trying something new, and then we want to see someone else doing it first, and then we're like, okay, then I can do it. And I think it's sort of like, whatever you make is going to be okay. So just allow yourself, if you have an instinct to do something. So like if you are a cook and you're like, I think I want to draw my recipes. It's like, you don't need to see if other people have done that. You can just give yourself permission. I always say the visual alphabet, which is, I'm sure you have a version of it, and maybe the same, I don't know, but that's your basics. Like get that down, you know, cause that is your language entry tool, you know?
Yep.
And it's like, there's not a human that can't make that, even if you have to do it with your toes or whatever.
And I would guess probably your extension on visual alphabet might even be build a visual library or a toolkit or something, right? So once you've nailed those, just start building in your mind, like how to draw things, so that when you're on the spot, you can pull it out of the.
Head. See, I think that's maybe one of the best kept secrets is that, and maybe people don't know that, so it would be important to emphasize that. I have a graphic vocabulary. I mean, I use the same icons for words all the time. And then it's just like a word. It's the same thing. Like, I don't invent a word. If I see something that's pretty, I don't try to come up with another word for pretty. I'm like, oh, it's pretty.
Yeah.
You know? So it's the same. It's like, oh, this dude's just said strategy. So I have three ways to say strategy visually. I mean, that's part of what makes it possible for me to work fast. Is that I already have this kit, and that is not scandalous. Like, I remember, and there's so many interesting assumptions that people have about, like, what's the purest form, and like, what's, you know, what's cheating. I'm like, are you nuts? Like, there's no cheating. There is only effort and application and seeing what happens, you know. It's just like somebody, because we do a lot of, sometimes on a big, large scale mural, we'll do a title before we go. And they're like, what? That's not improvisational. I'm like, I don't care. I'm like, what are you talking about?
It doesn't have to all be.
No, like, I will straight up draw a picture of the CEO prior to going, and then I will put stuff around it because it looks awesome. Like, I don't have a judgment about that, you know? So, but it's so interesting that people do. So, yes, a graphic vocabulary, 100%.
Excellent. Yeah. And now give me number three. What would you say? What do you think?
Well, what's coming to mind is having like peer collaborators, and that's sort of more in the game facilitation and the like visual thinking when you're conducting stuff with groups. But I always like to play with others, you know, like you don't have to do it all alone, you know, I mean, you don't have to sit always by yourself and hash it out. Like, you can just go to a meetup or go to a sketchnote group and then be inspired by other people. I think that's nice. And that's not instinctive for me. You know, like, it took me about 4 years to realize there's other writers that I could talk to when I was like in the painful process of writing. I was like, oh, there's like writers, like there's other people. So I think there's a lot of beauty to be found in connectivity with learners who are in your space, you know,
and I
would encourage that too.
Yep. And that redirects people to community, which we provide. So, I mean, you know, and people in the community love to help each other out. And so that's a natural one for someone maybe who's listening, who not really sure about this thing, you like it, but, you know, dive into the community. There's lots of great people in the community. Oh, mm-hmm. SketchNote Army and on the Twitter and everywhere.
Yeah.
So they're really helpful.
Yeah, you've done a really good job, Mike. I'm very, very impressed with what you've done in the last few years.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, I, again, I'll say I'll claim my 1.5%. And
I knew you would do that. Well, thank you. I don't know if you're done with your questions, but I was I was about to facilitate us, you know.
This is sort of the typical way we wrap it up. We end with practical things that you can apply, and I think these are three great ones. Not needing permission, you know, get that alphabet, the visual alphabet going, and build your library. Then there's no cheating, which I often tell people when they say they're going to Google Images to get so like that's I'm not like, cheating. That's like, reference.
That's just resourceful. Yeah.
And then finding community and people to collaborate with. Those are three fantastic recommendations for people to go forward from. So thanks so much for, you know, your impact on the community and what you do and how, you know, your perspective on how to use visuals in a different way. I think it's so good that we have a variety of voices, that it's not just this one monolithic voice, that there's many ways to do it. And even the community is picking up on that and doing things on their own that are different. And I think that's a healthy sign of a good community.
It is, because it means that it's alive, you know? Mm-hmm. It means that the tool is alive and animated. And that's really what its nature is. So that's awesome.
Yeah. So thanks so much for making time. And
of course.
I think people are going to love the podcast and look forward to lots of tweets on Twitter. So.
Oh, yeah. No, they'll all be from me. So don't worry. All right, Mike.
Well, that will wrap the show, everyone. Thanks for listening. And I look forward to another Girl Power episode in season 3 coming up next time.
Yeah.
And until then, we'll talk to you later.